Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anise Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about lung cancer with Dr. Dan Baffa. Dr. Baffa is Associate Professor of Surgery in the Section of Thoracic Surgery at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Dr. Anise Chagpar.
So, Dan, we hear a lot about lung cancer. Tell us a little bit more about how many people get lung cancer and how many people die of it in this country.
Well, lung cancer affects about 200,000 people each year in the United States. And it is one of those cancers that is one of the most dangerous cancers, meaning that at every stage, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, the lung cancer is more likely to shorten your life than a lot of other cancers that you commonly think of, such as breast and colon. So with 200,000 new cases of lung cancer a year, there are about 150,000 deaths each year, so it's a major healthcare problem in the United States. It's the nation's number one cancer killer.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, as a breast cancer doctor, lung cancer is the number one cancer killer of women as well. Overtook breast cancer, which is the number one cancer that affects women, but. As you say, lung cancer is far more lethal. And one of the reasons for that, I think, might be that it's harder to detect. I mean, when women come in, they get a mammogram and we find cancer early. What do people do to detect lung cancer?
So historically, lung cancer has not been one of the cancers that we had a good screening test for. So most patients would come to the attention of their doctor when they had a symptom. And unfortunately, once a symptom develops, a fair number of patients go beyond a point in which we are able to cure the lung cancer. That all changed with a recent study that was done that looked at the ability of CT scanning to screen patients felt to be at risk for lung cancer. And that study, which examined patients who were between the ages of 55 and 75, who had smoked within the past 15 years and had smoked an average of a pack a day for 30 years, it reduced the chances of dying of lung cancer by 20%.
Wow.
And that is very likely going to be the most significant research to improve the outcome of lung cancer, and probably in my lifetime. It's truly an enormous advance in the treatment of lung cancer.
So Dan, I mean, does that mean that everybody should get a CT scan, whether or not you smoke? Like, it should just be routine, just like every woman gets a mammogram over the age of 40? Should every person get a CT scan over the age of 50? Or is it really for those high-risk people?
So one of the interesting things about the national screening trial was that it really is not just a scan. It is picking the people at greatest risk to have lung cancer, but also patients that we can do something about. For instance, it doesn't help to screen somebody who has a whole bunch of medical problems in which, if you diagnose lung cancer, they're really not going to be able to tolerate the treatment and benefit from the early detection. And CT scans, they do have a fair bit of radiation with them. We're now doing low-dose CT scans, which just means we're able to reduce the amount of radiation. But the fact is, If you aren't in a population at a reasonable risk to develop lung cancer, you probably shouldn't be exposing yourself to that radiation. So if you've smoked a pack a day for 30 years on average, or half a pack a day for 60 years, but if you have a 30-pack year average, and at Yale, if you're between the ages of 55 and actually 80, and you have smoked within the past 15 years and you're otherwise relatively healthy, then we will evaluate you with a CT scan. But one of the real keys to this is it can't just be a CT scan. Screening is a process. And what I mean by that is a scan will find an abnormality in up to 28% of people. And the vast majority of these are actually not cancerous. And for the balance to work out, the clinicians that are evaluating you must be able to balance the risk of a cancer with the risk of having harm from unnecessary biopsies, unnecessary x-rays, and so on. So in order for a lung cancer screening to work, you really need to be evaluated by a program, not just to get a CT scan in isolation.
So are these things being offered throughout the country, where people who are heavy smokers can go and get evaluated by a team of people and get a CT scan that can be appropriately done?
So right now, Medicare is not covering these CT scans. We have reason to believe that ultimately this will change. There's Yale, as well as a number of other institutions, are very active in trying to persuade the federal government to include this in coverage. But presently, patients are either funding these out of pocket or are participating in free events. Yale has actually sponsored a couple of these, in which it's not really a scan, it's not just a CT scan, but the Yale nodule program will offer a free CT scan, as well as the entire nodule program or screening program, which includes an evaluation by somebody who can help you stop smoking if you are a smoker, currently a breathing evaluation. And so we're really trying to maximize the benefits of the screening process. We actually have an event November 8th, and I am told there are still a few slots available. And if any of your listeners were interested, you could certainly contact the Yale Nodule Program. And I believe the number is 203-200, and then the word lung, L-U-N-G, which I think comes out to 5864.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a phenomenal kind of program, especially for people who, can't afford to undergo such a process, but even for those who can, it seems really pretty comprehensive in terms of working up all of the potential issues for smokers. But lung cancer can happen in non-smokers too, right? So what happens with them?
So one out of seven lung cancers will happen in somebody who is a lifetime non-smoker. There are other established risk factors for lung cancer. Some of them are environmental, such as radon or arsenic or even asbestos. Some of them were exposed to secondhand smoke, and there certainly is a genetic component. Patients with a family history, for instance, are at an increased risk of developing lung cancer. Right now, the screening guidelines have not addressed that population as far as their risk. Ultimately, I suspect that that people with a family history will be included in screening protocols, but at present, they're really not.
What proportion of people who get lung cancer are smokers versus non-smokers?
So a smoking history can be elicited in about somewhere around 85% of people who are diagnosed with lung cancer. What is unclear is whether or not all of those are directly linked to the smoking. The vast majority, we believe, are smoking-associated cancers. However, if you think about it, if one out of seven is destined to happen in somebody without a smoking history, some of them may have happened to have smoked at one point in their life. And there certainly the non-smoking associated cancers appear to have a different biology and come about through a different mechanism and present their own set of treatment and outcome issues.
Well, I want to get into the treatment issues and the nuances of smoking versus non-smoking related cancers. But just to kind of wrap up something that you said when we were talking about screening, you had mentioned that many of the screening protocols allowed for CT scans if you had smoked more than a 30-pack year history within the past 15 years. So that means that even if you quit 14 years and 364 out of 365 days ago, you would still be offered screening. So is there ever a time when your risk actually like disappears, like you can be forgiven for the mistake of smoking years ago?
Well, the consequences of smoking on a person's health are multifactorial. And if we just think about the cancer consequences, specifically lung cancer consequences, lung cancer in smokers is actually not the most common cause of smoking-associated death. Only 6% of smokers will be diagnosed with lung cancer. Smokers are much more likely to have their life span affected by emphysema and cardiovascular diseases. Both of those respond very predictably to quitting smoking. So people that quit smoking pretty much shortly after they quit will have a benefit in their long-term survival. Now, there are a number of studies that have examined the impact of ongoing smoking once you've been diagnosed with lung cancer, and the outcomes appear to be better in people that quit smoking as opposed to people who continue to smoke. So without a question, if somebody is to quit smoking really at any stage of their life, they do a tremendous amount of benefit to prolonging their life. And that's why we think this is an integral part of the screening process. Now, why it would take 15 years to develop a lung cancer, or why that window is tailored the way it is, the study that has led us to support screening, investigators had to design the population they felt to be at highest risk. Now, there certainly is a dropping off of your risk the longer you go without smoking. It never returns to that of a non-smoker, but there's a predictable decline in your smoking-associated cancer risk the further you get out from quitting. So if you're thinking about quitting, the sooner the better. But there really is never a point in time where quitting doesn't have very real payoff as far as your overall outcome.
Well, we're going to pick up on smoking and lung cancer right after we take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about lung cancer with my guest, Dr. Dan Boffa.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2014, over 45,000 new cases of pancreatic cancer will be diagnosed in the United States. Pancreatic cancer is the fourth most frequent cause of cancer death. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers such as Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven to make innovative new treatments available to patients. Clinical trial participation is offered for treatment of advanced stage and metastatic pancreatic cancer using chemotherapy and other novel therapies for the disease. FOLFIRINOX, a combination of five different chemotherapies, is the latest advancement in the treatment of metastatic pancreatic cancer. There's continued research being done at centers like Yale and around the world looking into targeted therapy and a recently discovered marker, HENT1. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. For more information, go to yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Dan Boffa. We're talking about lung cancer, and before the break, we were talking about screening, which is a protocol that's offered in this really great multidisciplinary fashion with smoking cessation and all kinds of risk assessment for smokers with CT scans. But what we discovered in our conversation was that non-smokers can also get lung cancer, but more interestingly, that the two are very different, cancers that arise as smoking-related cancers versus non-smoking-related cancers. So, Dan, I wanted to pick up on our conversation there. Tell us a little bit about how the two are biologically different, genetically different. Can you really tell that these are different just at a molecular level?
So, There are differences that trend across pretty much all of the aspects that you mentioned. The population statistics are very different. We see these classic non-smoking associated cancers more often in Asian populations. They're more common in females. The types of cancers, as they look under the microscope, are much more weighted towards the adenocarcinomas. Lung cancers, there's two big umbrellas of types of lung cancer. There's small cell and non-small cell. Small cell, which is about 13% of all lung cancer, is highly associated with smoking. Of the non-small cell, there's adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. The non-smokers tend to be much more heavily weighted to adenocarcinoma. And from a molecular standpoint, there are certain mutations that are much more common in the non-smoking population. And mutations are abnormalities in the DNA. And the ones that we're really interested in are the ones that allow us to use what we call targeted chemotherapy that is specific to the cancer cells. That's different from most chemotherapy, which happens to kill cancer cells, but is also affects the entire body. Targeted therapy certainly can have effects throughout the body, but is much more targeted towards the cancer cells that have these mutations.
So wait a minute. So you're telling me that somebody who doesn't smoke, who gets lung cancer, can get these genetic abnormalities that you can target with certain targeted therapies, whereas people who get lung cancer due to smoking either don't have the same genes or have different genes?
So there are different frequencies in the two populations. So there's certainly patients with smoking-associated cancers that have mutations, and it seemingly every month a new mutation is discovered that allows us to apply a new form of targeted therapy. The pattern is distinct, though. We see certain EGFR mutation frequencies that are much different and much higher in non-smoking patient populations than we see in the smoking patient population. But the both smoking-associated cancers and non-smoking-associated cancers are the study the focus of a great deal of study to identify these targetable mutations. And we have a number of clinical trials, both in smokers and non-smokers, looking to take advantage of these mutations. So I certainly, if somebody were to be diagnosed with a cancer and had a smoking history, I would. There are certainly a number of mutations and targeted therapies that are being explored to treat those patients, as well as the non-smokers.
So you used a term which many of our listeners may not be familiar with, EGFR. Tell us a little bit more about EGFR and what it is and why it's important in lung cancer.
So under normal conditions within the body, their cells react to signals from their environment. And the EGFR is one of those proteins on a cell whose responsibility it is to transmit a signal from the environment into the cell. And of the many reactions that signal can have, one is to stimulate growth. And you can imagine if you had a fire alarm that was malfunctioning and was constantly giving the signals to react, there would be great consequences within the building in which that fire alarm was going off. Well, if the EGFR pathway is abnormal, cells can have the response to divide can be abnormally affected by this abnormal signaling through this pathway. And so there are a class of compounds that or medications that target this pathway to blunt the effect of this signaling. And it turns out that a certain number of cancers become addicted to this signal, and blocking this signal actually greatly reduces the cancer's ability to grow and potentially spread. And we have a whole range of medications that are coming out to target not just the EGFR, but a number of signaling pathways that cancer cells appear to be functioning abnormally, and the cancer cells become somewhat addicted to.
So, but Dan, you're a surgeon. So, I mean, are all lung cancers treated with targeted therapies or chemotherapies, or are some treated with surgery as well? How does that work?
Well, whenever we meet a patient, we must first decide where is the patient's cancer presently. And often patients will have something abnormal on an X-ray or a CT scan that may or may not reflect what's going on throughout their entire body. If a cancer is contained within the lung and the region and the lymph nodes in that area, then they are potentially curable with surgery, possibly the use of chemotherapy or radiation in combination, sort of a multimodality or single modality plan. There are patients in which the cancer has either spread already, and we can see that on the scans, to other vital organs, or whose tumor has other features that lead us to believe they are very likely to have microscopic spread. Those patients doing surgery, and while surgery gets safer and safer every year, it doesn't make sense to go down that pathway if the cancer is already spread. I sort of use the analogy to patients that if your house catches on fire because of the furnace, if the whole house is on fire, you don't risk your life to go remove the furnace. But most of my patients are patients who the cancer remains contained where it started within the lung. And we have a number of advances to minimize the impact of surgery on the patient's health and probably on their ability to receive additional treatment. So we specialize in minimally invasive surgery, which is doing the traditional lung cancer operation, but through smaller incisions without traumatizing the chest wall. So we usually don't crack, break, or spread any ribs. We just go through small incisions using a camera to conduct the cancer operation.
Is that kind of like how people take out gallbladders these days instead of making a big cut like they used to?
That's exactly right. The key, much like the gallbladder, is that doing surgery through small incisions has to follow the same principles. And you really, because it's a cancer operation, while small incisions are nice, you have to follow the principles, meaning you have to completely remove the tumor. You have to ensure it's surrounded by a rim of normal tissue. You have to evaluate the lymph nodes. We do that with a minimally invasive approach. However, if it seems that the tumor is more extensive, then we use traditional approaches, but we, with the modification that we don't cut any of the big muscles of the chest wall. We just sort of spread them out of our way.
So we've talked a little bit about targeted therapy, which is a form of chemotherapy, and a bit about surgery, but you mentioned in passing radiation. So where does radiation fall into the whole paradigm of how we treat lung cancer?
So there, if you had to take therapy and separate it into two broad categories, chemotherapy being through the bloodstream addresses the whole body, whereas local therapy is targeting areas in which you see tumor on the CT scans. Radiation is like surgery in that it is a form of local therapy. And we use radiation in combination with surgery in patients who are at risk to have tumor recur or show up again in tissues that are not able to be removed at the time of surgery. So one example would be as if a tumor came close to a part of the heart and we removed the tumor completely, but there were lymph nodes near the heart and main windpipe. We know that despite removing every visible lymph node, there is a chance that it can come back in the microscopic lymph nodes, and so we will add radiation to those patients. There's also a form of radiation which is called stereotactic body radiosurgery, or sometimes called cyberknife at some places, that is a much more aggressive form of radiation. And that's a treatment we use in patients in place of surgery if they're either too sick to have surgery or if we feel that the consequences of surgery would leave them with an unacceptable quality of life. You know, a lot of our patients don't have normal lungs. And at the end of the day, we want our patients to live as long as they can, as well as they can. And we don't help anybody by curing them of cancer and leaving them unable to do the things that they want to do to enjoy their life. And so we certainly have some patients where we will treat them with radiation because we're concerned that a surgical intervention would leave them incapacitated.
So, Dan, I love that line that you used, which was, we want our patients to live as long as they can, as well as they can. And I want to come back to a couple of points that I heard you say just to get some clarification. One is you used the term a few times of cure. Is this really a disease that you cure, that people can live a long time without getting their cancer back just in the last minute? Let us know how much hope you can give patients with lung cancer.
So we cure of patients that are stage one, we cure the majority of patients. As the stage goes up, the cure rate certainly goes down. We used to think of cancer like a broken arm. You either fix it or you don't. We now, in many cases, treat cancer more like a chronic disease, more like diabetes, so that when it's a problem, we treat you. And when you respond and you go into remission, we back off and we follow you. So again, the equation remains the same. We want everybody to live as long as they can, as well as they can. And we have to balance the benefits of treatment with the risks of treatment.
Dr. Dan Botha is Associate Professor of Surgery in the Section of Thoracic Surgery at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, and we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.